Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Bob Dylan, thanks for being on the Gary Hour. Is that really you?
Darkness at the break of noon, shadows even the silver spoon, handmade blade, a child's balloon.
Yeah, smooth. So you've stopped playing music. Are you going to start again?
No.
But how can you be fulfilled as a professional miniature golfer and not even be good at it?
Isn't that something?
Well, how'd you decide on something so mundane as miniature golf?
It just came right out of that wellspring of creativity, I would think, you know?
So you're passionate about this mini sport.
Yeah.
I love the way you hit the ball, the double spin on one leg while screaming in tongues.
There's a magic to that. And it's not Siegfried and Roy kind of magic, you know? It's a different kind of a penetrating magic.
A mini golf soul penetrating magic?
Probably.
Well, you do seem happy.
I really didn't consider myself happy or unhappy. I always knew that there was something out there that I needed to get to.
Well, I guess you found your destiny in miniature golf. It's a good feeling.
Who's to say how long that's going to last?
Welcome to episode 22. What a great episode this is. We talked to Kevin Allison, who you might know from the State Comedy Troupe on MTV. He's currently the host and creator of the popular podcast Risk. Risk is a podcast where people tell true stories they wouldn't dare tell in public, but they do. They tell them in microphones with everybody listening. It's a good podcast. Take a risk. All right. Man, this is good. What a good conversation. You're going to need your digital notepads. You're going to need your pencils out for this one because there's so many references and books and things to look up. You might need to pause the podcast and Google some stuff. There's wealth of information here. We talk about the benefits of a good conversation, the importance of connections, letting your friends evolve, giving them the freedom and space to do so, and finding out who that other you is, that person that you talk to all day and night, who is that person? I had a great time. This is a great conversation full of laughs. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. This conversation with me, Matt Kaplan, and Kevin Allison. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been in the new year, I've been doing the green tea rather than the coffee.
That's the healthy move.
Yeah.
Are you still on the sober train?
Still, yeah, still no alcohol. So that's good.
So not completely on the sober train.
No, I mean, I have not outruled marijuana. My deal is now, don't buy it. Don't own it myself.
Right, just mooch off everybody.
Yeah. So now I'm that guy. But, you know, it is, to me, an incredibly, like, a much more practical way to do things. Because what will happen is I'll be on tour. And after a show, you know, I'm kind of emotionally exhausted because the show itself was exhausted. I'm exhausting from traveling. And then the fans kind of want to hang out. And I think it's important to hang out with them. And so to have a little bit of a fan's pot is, to me, you know, just like, well, what the hell, you know?
Yeah.
It's owning pot where I would end up doing it every day. And that just becomes untenable for me. That really gets in the way of my having clarity, having energy, having some sort of feeling of stability with my emotions and all that.
So pot was one of those things for you where you couldn't moderate it or just use it when you need it?
You know, I could definitely moderate it much more easily than alcohol.
Yeah.
I still would end up doing it too often if I owned it.
It doesn't have that downward ski slope thing of alcohol where it's like, I could keep drinking forever.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the way that that works is, unfortunately, you get to be my age, 45, and you realize, oh shit, I've got like, you know, so many things that I'm kind of addictive about, you know? There's junk food, pot, alcohol poppers is another one. The gay men sniff these things when they're having sex. And, you know, most gay men would just have it set aside for like when they're actually with someone. No, I started doing that every goddamn day for masturbating.
How long does a popper last?
It only lasts about maybe 40, 50 seconds.
You know? Wow.
Yeah. So that becomes really embarrassing because they're constantly getting lost in the comforter. You know what I mean? You are stopping having sex like every 3 minutes or so and going, where are the poppers? Where are the poppers? And you really feel like an addict when you're doing that.
Yeah, going through couch cushions.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, with that, I realized, yes, it really does enhance things. It does make me hornier. It does seem to make things like, you know, I don't know, in the same way that alcohol makes things kind of warm and romantic and fuzzy and all that kind of stuff. But it's so distracting. So pulls you out of being connected to the person that you're with.
I would imagine. And do you end up relying on the poppers for the eroticness of it?
Yeah. It's, you know, I thought that I was a real pig with them, but there are guys who would just like, you know, like just take these gigantic pulls off of, you know, sniffs of this stuff constantly. And it can, like, it's one of those things that scientists have not really told us, here's what this does to you. But it's got to be killing some major brain cells.
Yeah, you know? Like a whippet or something.
Yeah, I mean, I will, because I was doing them for, I don't know, 20 years every day, I mean, I'm sure that sometime in my 60s or 70s, I'll have a little bit of a stroke and it'll be like, hey, what caused that? The poppers.
I don't know if you're the right person to ask, but I wonder why it never made it over to the straight sex world. Like, why are there certain drugs that, like, oh, gay people use these for sex, but straight people, we don't need them.
It is interesting. I think it has to do with...
Is our sex lame?
Well, no, I think it is. I think that it feels dirty, you know. Poppers feel dirty. Now, the reputation that they have is that they loosen your sphincter. You know what I mean?
Okay, right.
But that's really just like a wives' tale. That's not what gets people hooked to them. Because, God, you know, if you go to a sex club, guys are just making out and sniffing poppers. You know what I mean? Like, it's clearly like what gets it to stick with people is just that it's a Rush. It's literally the most famous brand is called Rush.
Uh-huh.
And so, no, I think that one of the reasons it hasn't stuck with straight people is because probably women have a sort of more refined effect on how sex is gone about, you know? Right. And I would think that they would be a little bit like, that's a little gross and kind of getting in the way, you know what
right.
I mean?
Well, let's ease into it.
Yeah. Whereas gay men are you know, I have had sex with guys before who have said to me, you need too many enhancements, you know, between having to wear a cock ring or wanting to put on some nipple clamps or needing this kind of lube and yada. And I admit, you know, I all that kind of stuff can get very habit forming.
Right.
So
you build up a tolerance and all of a sudden you need all this stuff.
Absolutely. And then to consistently be drunk or stoned also makes it harder to have an erection, which makes you want to have a tighter cock ring. I mean, it's all, you know, like I am just an all or nothing kind of guy. Yeah. And one thing tends to lead to the next, you know? So in my latter half of my life, you know, I'm about to turn 46 in February. Mm-hmm. I just want to start trying to cultivate more positive habits
right.
than negative ones. You know, habits like meditation.
Yeah.
I bought some yoga pants.
All right, you're fine now.
you've practically done all the yoga you can do.
Yeah. I bought the pants.
Have you taken the tag off the pants yet?
No, I don't. They are still in the bag.
Well, the meditation can really increase your sensitivity to things.
I think so. I mean, my goal is, and also it's another, like, in order to maintain a good meditation practice, mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, drinking or smoking pot all the time is not going to help that,
no.
you know,
yeah.
because meditation is, as far as I've experienced it so far, about kind of letting the brain calm the mind, you know, with all the, you know, rush of thoughts and emotions, kind of slow down a little bit. And connect to something, I don't know, still and clear and kind of unruffled, you know?
Yeah, the way Eckhart, do you ever read any Eckhart Tolle?
I have not, actually, no.
He puts it in a neat way. It's like, we're always in a conversation with ourselves. And how he came to meditation was, one day he was like, who is that person I'm talking to?
Yeah.
And that, to him, is meditation, getting in touch with that person that you're always talking to inside of yourself.
Yeah. There's a fascinating book called Radiant Mind. Mm-hmm. It's an English guy wrote it, but he's all about like getting to know that person and then obliterating that going beyond the person you're in conversation with and getting to know the nothing.
Right. Well, who is that other person? Are you supposed to obliterate the person that's talking to the other person, or do you obliterate the other person?
Well, I don't know that obliterate is the word that he would use.
More like unify?
Yeah, I think so. Well, that's how I tend to think of it so mm-hmm. far. Is, you know, David Lynch described it as, he was talking specifically about transcendental meditation, that there is a unified field, according to quantum physicists, right? Mm-hmm. This is like kind of the base of the creative energy in the universe. And the way that quantum physicists often describe it is as it's kind of like that still energy at the bottom of the ocean
right.
rather than on the surface. So David Lynch says that he feels like what you're doing when you meditate is you're normally on the surface where all the waves are crashing and seagulls and you're listening to voices and yada yada. And then when you meditate, you kind of sink down and you're closer then to that big mind, that the big other,
right.
To which you are ultimately made up of, you know?
Well, when they do brain scans of like Zen monks, for example, it will read almost like they're dead. It's like a flat line. And most probably are an average New Yorker. It's like crazy waveforms everywhere.
Yeah. I am one of those people who, you know, it really is interesting to ask, who am I talking to? Because sometimes you're talking to, like, as comedians or performers, a lot of times we're talking to an audience that isn't there. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, just on the way here, I was listening over and over again to this story that I want to tell in San Francisco on Thursday. And so it's very interesting. There is a persona that you develop
yeah.
in order to speak to the big other that is other people, right? So that voice is often going through my head.
Well, is that persona just a simplified version and heightened, obviously, but like a simple version where people can get who you are as a character?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that one of the problems with that, especially with Risk, with the show that I've created, is the goal of Risk is to start peeling off masks, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
Is to be yourself in ways that you're not used to being in front of other people. Be yourself in ways that you might ideally, you know, be in front of a therapist or your very close friend. You know, like, for example, my husband, we're no longer together, but it was very important to me when I was able to cry in front of him.
Yeah. It brought you closer together.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was very important to me when there was a moment when he was able to cry in front of me. You know what I mean? I'm someone who cries very, very rarely. So very few people have seen it, you know, family members from, you know, when I was a kid mostly. But yeah, ideally what we're going for in Risk is, if you have a side of yourself that's kind of freaky, allowing your freaky side to show, or a side of yourself that's kind of filthy to let that side show, yeah. or a part of yourself that's very spiritual or whatever. So the idea is, like, for a person like me who's been telling stories on the show for now 7 years, it can be a little bit daunting, because sometimes I think, all right, what haven't I revealed?
Right.
And it actually gets scarier the further along you go, you know?
You're constantly looking for more things to reveal.
Yeah, and you question. Like, the longer you tell stories, too, true stories, the more you look back at some of your old stories and say, gosh, I can't distinguish whether that really happened or if I just made some of that up. Like it's... Because we do that naturally, right? Yeah, I mean, whenever we...
You fill in the gaps.
You fill in gaps, yeah. Your absolutely. Mind just has to do that. But every now and again, I'll have a sudden memory flash and I'll realize, no, that's not the way that went.
Right.
And then sometimes I'll be like, oh my God, that's amazing for the story to admit I've been telling it this way, but I just realized this.
Does that happen during meditation? Your memory
no.
improves?
Oh, well, you know, it's interesting. The advice that I'd give to people who plan on meditating is not to have hopes or expectations
yes.
around it.
No agenda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The more that I have given up on expecting or hoping it, like, when I first got into transcendental meditation, I picked up that book by David Lynch.
Yeah.
Catching the Big Fish. And, you know, there's a guy who wrote a book called Transcendence, which is, he's like one of the lead guys at TM.
Yeah.
And he warns people. Now, you might read the book by David Lynch, but just be aware, not everyone has a Lynchian sort of experience. Because he describes it as the very first time he ever did it. He said, it was if I was in an elevator and someone snipped the cord and I just fell into an eternal abyss of bliss. I'm like, holy shit, I want that.
Right. So you're like, when's it happening? When's it happening?
Right, yeah. right.
It's almost like Googling your dates before you go on a date. You know, you have this, oh, they're this person.
Right. And, you know, he also says that a large chunk of Mulholland Drive occurred to him while he was meditating.
Oh.
But no. What I mostly get out of it is the heart rate slows, there are moments often that clearly go a little hypno, you know, uh-huh. moments of where a bit of a dream just started to happen, you mm-hmm. know, or that sort of thing. But mostly it's, to me, it's just about calming down
yes.
so far. Yeah, yeah.
When you're having this dream come up, does your conscious mind come up to, and it's like, oh, there's a dream I'm having. And then you're like, oh, shut up, conscious mind. Get back to meditating.
A little bit. But the more I've done it, the more I've found that I just, you know, what the Maharishi used to say is innocently returning to the mantra. Like in other right. words, not yelling at yourself right. or not grasping back for the mantra, but just like,
observing.
Almost, just like almost carefree, just returning back to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Getting back to risk. With risk, what I think what you were saying was you're asking people to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really great thing that we're seeing as a cultural shift, and I think risk is part of this, is that people in the olden days, vulnerability was weakness.
Mm.
And I think what we're seeing is like you can be vulnerable and still be strong. Maybe it's even a strength.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're absolutely right. It's a very interesting moment right now culturally, and that we're very much a part of, is that the internet has given voice mm-hmm. or has given a space for a lot of people to express themselves in ways they might not have before.
Right.
For example, like women are now very, very like, just have at their fingertips the ability to point out quite quickly, hey, so-and-so expressed this thing, and let us show you, let us, you know, like deconstruct this and show you why it's sexist, right? And so that's really exciting and powerful.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's obviously going to be very daunting to a lot of people, right? Mm. Like, I always feel like the everything good that happens in a cultural evolution also has a dark side. You know, like, for example...
I was just going to ask for an example. Thank you. That's great.
Have you seen the show Transparent?
Yes.
Yeah. The scene or the whole episode where they go to a queer women's festival
mm-hmm.
and there's this almost like antagonistic and shutting out. You know, they have to literally shout man on the land when the people come, when the men come to right. get rid of the sanitation. And it's almost like a panic. And so the trans woman who's there, who is the lead character of the whole show, is they let her know she's not welcome there. Mm. And she says later in the show, you know, I want to warn you, to her daughter who's becoming a good friend of one of these lesbians that attends this camp. You know, it's usually better the people who are not so
militant
about yeah. dogma, you mm-hmm. know? So, yeah, I feel like, yes, the conversation is getting richer and richer mm-hmm. as, you know, the internet has places like Risk or whatever, even Twitter and Facebook, for people to like express themselves. But at the same time, you see a lot of people like ganging up on, like FetLife is a perfect example uh-huh. in the kink community, where if someone doesn't like, especially a dom straight male, a dominant straight male uh-huh. on FetLife knows he can at any time be accused of not having given someone aftercare in a genuine way, or having hit someone without the exact sort of consent that someone wanted. And a person like that can be made a pariah in the kink community. Like it can just go mob mentality can yeah. just go out of control. And so there are cases like that where it's a little worrisome sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you get to see human nature.
Yeah, you
really
do.
Really just human yeah. nature.
Yeah, you do. You do. But I am of the belief that more talking is generally better than less. You
yeah.
know, that the more people express how they're really feeling about things, the better it is. Because I do feel like, you know, our parents, or my parents at least, come from the 50s. You know, they were kids in the 50s. and very Catholic.
Super buttoned up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were just, like, sex, for example. My mother, sex, even the word sex itself is just like rings alarms in her brain. You know?
Right.
It's just not something to talk about.
Is that religious or is it generational?
I think it's a little bit of both, you know? In Catholicism, we were taught that the Blessed Virgin Mary was just like second only to Jesus for in importance. And her, what she was pictured as was silent, submissive, very much just taking care of things. Like Jesus in the Gospels himself, on more than one occasion, is rather arrogant toward her. You know, dismisses her, says, who's my mother? You know, like as in it doesn't really matter and stuff like that. And she's unwavering, you know, she'll never not be at his side, you know.
That's very old school male-female relationships right there.
Yeah.
Are you still following Catholicism?
Mm-mm. No. No.
Okay,
no.
Good. Now I know how freely I can.
There's something I wonder about, though. We talk about social media. We talk about shows like Risk, where people are more vulnerable and more open. But is it making it to everyday life? Or is it just still, well, I have an audience, so I can be vulnerable? So one thing I was thinking about, I saw this girl I've known for 20-plus years talking about her social anxiety and how it's crippling. And it's like, I've known you for all these years. It's never something that's come up in conversation. Had you told me that, I can tell you about my own social awkwardness. And we could have been having much better and truer conversations for 20 years.
She did it on Facebook?
On Facebook. She talks about it. But it's like never something that would come up in conversation.
Oh, that's
I feel like
really
sometimes if you don't have some sort of an audience besides person to person, people still are closed off.
That's a great point. Yeah, my friend JC said that she had a relationship with a guy in college at Harvard that got really, really weird and hurt her for decades, and then found out, like through some sort of post, that he had some sort of debilitating social anxiety and yada yada. Yeah, it's the very same story. That is fascinating. That you know, you hope that we're I am now doing this, for example. I have a week or a day each month that I make a point of being in a room with other gay men, just socializing, right? Because I've realized, gosh, I've gotten so busy and so whatever that, like, I don't really commune in the way that I used to in my 20s with other gay men. And then, you know, I want to start making a point of making some other sorts of social things that I regularly
sounds really healthy.
Make a point of doing because, yes, there's that. I think that we are becoming kind of a little bit more interpersonally disconnected.
I mean, it's sad that she feels safe posting it publicly on Facebook rather than talking to a good friend. But my theory with people and social media is that you see their fake face, but then sometimes you also see someone's really true self.
Yeah.
Because whenever someone's out, they're putting on a social face. But when they're at home behind the computer, you could see who they really are.
It's true. It can be a little bit like alcohol. You know what I mean? Mm. In that, you know,
the inside comes out.
Yeah. Like at a Risk show, the audience afterwards is going, or and even during the show, is incredibly supportive, you know? And they'll have wonderful things to say to the storytellers afterwards. But then when we post that same show online, people feel free to put on the comments pages, ugh, I know the guy tried to commit suicide and all, but God damn, is his voice annoying and yada, you know, people say stuff like that where it's like, wow, okay, that's very not helpful. And would you ever say that to that person's face? Had you been there that night?
Do you think it's the same audience, the same people that come to the show? Are they the same people posting it? Or are these people that would never come to a show and they're just trolls by nature?
That's an interesting point. I would say that it's, you're probably right. You're probably right that people who have actually made it out to the shows probably have much more of a, we get it, that we're supposed to be supportive of whatever comes our way, or just keep our mouths shut if someone rubs us the wrong way.
Right.
You know? Whereas, yeah, a lot of people, you know, are just, oh, I also listened to these other podcasts and happened on this one, and I want to.
I'm interested in these social gatherings that you're thinking of doing. I think it sounds like a great thing, not just for you, but for everybody. I kind of feel that way about this podcast. Like, I love getting people here. It's one of the few times I can talk to someone for a long time and in depth because everyone's really busy.
Yeah.
I'm reading this book by Brian Grazer, and he has these like curiosity conversations, he calls them.
Uh-huh.
And he just finds someone that he's interested in, and he tries to get them to talk to him, and he just asks them all these questions, and this is how he finds things out. And that kind of sounds like what you were talking about. You just want to commune with people.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I find, you know, like, I'll give an example. There was a guy I went to who was a couple of years ahead of me at my high school.
Mm-hmm.
And he reached out to me on Facebook, and he was like, hey, we should get together. And I could tell that he had started listening to Risk and yada yada. But I also knew that he was a gay man, and I also knew that he wasn't my type. So my initial, the barriers came down.
Right.
I was just like, oh, he wants to go out on a date, and well, it turned out that wasn't the case at all. You know, we got together. He made it clear. Oh, I know. I listened to the podcast. I know your type. You just seem like really interesting to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And we get together now on a regular basis just to sit down and chat. And he is very much like a free thinking kind of, he's an atheist, and he has all sorts of interesting opinions about being perfectly happy being single as opposed to ever wanting to.
What an alternate perspective. Yeah.
So just sitting down and talking to someone like that can be really, I can't say enough about it, how profound it can be to, yeah, sit down and make an actual face-to-face connection with someone.
And be comfortable with that conversation and not like posting afterwards, like, oh, here's a snippet from the conversation
that
we had, or like making sure that you post a picture with your friend that you just had, that like, it's still, for some people, it's still not a real enough moment unless the whole world knows that it happened.
That is this entire podcast.
It's true. It's like, that's like, there is a positive and a negative side to it. Like today in my taxi cab, I got in a taxi cab, and I noticed that the cab driver turned the volume up when he heard that Charlie Parker was coming next. And I said, yeah, you gotta love Charlie Parker. And instantly, all of a sudden, we're just like having this incredibly, like, he was very upset that some people like Coltrane and Sonny Rollins over Charlie Parker. So we got into this conversation, and afterwards, I was like, you know, had to tweet about it, you know, but part of the tweeting is like, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, part of this is just showing off that I know who Charlie Parker, what I mean? Yeah.
But it's also people connecting with you.
Yeah.
You can kind of find a downside to almost anything.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. That's what I was saying before, you know, that like there is a potential downside to anything. You know
exactly.
What I mean? Yeah. Speaking of David Lynch, I think his entire storytelling like gets at that same thing, you know, that there is always darkness and light. Yeah.
And with the book, I could see its danger, because it's like, oh yeah, I want to meditate because I want to experience that bliss and write a brilliant movie like Mulholland Drive, which is really not why you should be meditating.
Right. Oh my goodness.
What are you going to call these social gatherings?
Well, I called this on Facebook. What I did is I just invited every gay man I know on Facebook.
Uh-huh.
And it's a private group. So it's called Kevin's Big Gay Soiree.
They're all like, Kevin wants to have a crazy orgy.
No, I make very explicit that it's just, you know, having beers at some bar.
Kevin's platonic orgy.
Yeah, right. Who knows what'll happen with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do. You know, I would kind of like, I don't know, like to make a point of doing more of that kind of thing. It's hard because the busier we get, you know. I am interesting in what we were just talking about before. I am give it left to my own devices, I will be a homebody and start to isolate and go into introversion, you know? I think that a lot of performers have a complex relationship between their introversion and their extroversion. Mm-hmm. And I know that in the 12 years after the state broke up, I didn't handle that well. I let stage fright and social anxiety get the best of me, mm-hmm. and spent 90% of my energy just searching for low-paying, humiliating survival jobs like catering, you know? Yeah, really kind of like went off into my own universe most of the time.
Do you think you searching for those low-paying survival jobs, as you call it, was a self-destruction or just a survival mechanism?
No, I think, well, it was definitely, in my conscious mind, it was a survival mechanism. You know, I used to tell myself, oh, well, other members of the, because I was always comparing myself to the other members of
naturally,
the state,
yeah.
Right? And I would say, oh, well, several of them are trust fund babies, and a couple of them just have great connections to other people, and yada, yada, yada. There were cliques in the state, of course, and there's no such thing as an egalitarian democracy, which we said we were. But no, there's always backhand deals and stuff like that. And I was always the odd man out. I was the guy who was in his own universe, you know? Mm. And that is a persona that I play up in a lot of my stories, you know?
Right.
That I am that comedic character who's always like, what the fuck are we going to do about him? You know what I mean?
Right. But do you think now looking back, let's say from 25 years ago when you were in college with the state, is it exaggerated in your mind that you were so separate and different from everyone else? And you can look, oh, you know, this guy or this guy, he was probably a little felt in his own world as well.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
God, yes. Mm-hmm. I have a different perspective now. Like, for example, the state has reunited. Mm-hmm. It was now, I guess, a couple of years ago in L.A. We did a show. It was Jack Black's. He does a festival out in L.A. in the summertime. And so we spent a week rehearsing this show together. And it was really fascinating to be able to sit back and think, oh, well, now this person has really kind of changed and is actually more compassionate and more, I don't know, thoughtful. And this person is still kind of fucked up.
Have you stayed in touch throughout the years with everyone?
Oh, yeah. We're all very much like, we have an email chain that is just nonstop silliness. Yeah.
One thing about friends and when you've known them for a long time is like some friends will allow you to change and evolve.
Yes.
And some friends won't. They're like, oh, you're like this. I'm like, I don't think I'm like that anymore.
Oh, my God. I deal with this. I think I can talk about it pretty openly with JC.
Uh-huh.
JC is the producer of Risk, mm-hmm. and the business mind behind, the creative mind behind it. She's the business mind behind it. And so we meet every day on Skype to go over emails because just keeping up with emails is insane. She has taken on this sort of dominatrix sort of role with me. You know what I mean?
I like that this is coming out now. I thought I was privy to this.
That she, you know, is constantly like slapping me and saying, pay attention, get your act together, get things done, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, we talk a lot about personal stuff too, like diet and exercise and all that kind of stuff. And when I did give up drinking, start trying to eat a lot more vegan, start doing this meditation stuff, I started to, well, actually, things weren't ruffling me quite so much. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't having that, you know? Like, she would say something that I would normally, you know, be like, you shut the fuck up. Just let me do what I'm trying to get done here or whatever. And she'd say that same sort of thing. And I wouldn't react that way. Mm-hmm. And she would be like, wow, you must be really struggling with it. Or I'd text something like, oh, I shouldn't have got my hopes up so much about this date I was just on. And
right.
she would text back, always so negative and yada. And I'm like, No, I was literally just healthily saying I shouldn't have got my hopes so high up. You know what I mean?
I do.
So friends develop these patterns of kind of enjoying your foibles and your flaws and like poking at you. Mm-hmm. And when you do start to evolve, that can make friends rather uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's almost like having a beginner's mind with friendships too.
Yeah.
You know, just like letting people evolve and keep taking a little step back.
Yeah.
It's really annoying. I have a friend that she will not let me just be who I am now. And it's almost sort of like, I don't want to. That was me 15 years ago. If I want to hang out with you as that person, you know?
Yeah.
Forget that.
Yeah. That is interesting.
Yeah, with a lot of things, it's important to kind of keep that open mind about, you know, it really pertains to the meditation and pertains to friendships.
It's easier said than done. You know, like, I went into a podcast recently and it was all about kink, right? Mm-hmm. And it was with a guy and a girl, and the girl was half Asian American, right? And at the end of the interview, we were like, well, is that the end of the conversation? Yeah. When then she pulled out a piece of paper, she's like, no, actually, I have one more thing I'd like to bring up. And it was basically, aren't you creepy for admitting in your stories that you have a preference for Asian men?
Oh.
Isn't that fetishizing and objectifying Asian men? And if you were heterosexual, would you be able to talk that way? I was like,
did it rub you the wrong way?
No. That was like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting that we can tackle this topic. Mm-hmm. But the energy, the vibe that she was giving off,
like a gotcha.
Exactly. Yeah. It was kind of as if the framing of the issue,
right?
She was wearing a pair of glasses as to how we were going to talk about this.
It wasn't an open-ended.
I was on the defensive.
She put you on the stand there.
So it was, and that I think is like, I heard this talk by Krishnamurti where he was talking about how on more and more, like probably ever since like Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley, when people do get into conversations on TV nowadays, it's usually not like an open-ended, let's see what insights we can gain. Might you be able to tell me something I had never considered before?
Right.
It's, I've got my agenda. Mm. Let's see if I can get you with the filter I've got.
It's more of a debate than a conversation.
Yeah. And that, I think, you know, I've heard a lot of people into, you know, I've been studying this stuff called three principles lately. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people who study that talk about listening for insight rather than listening for adding to what you already believe and know. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's very important. And we see that a lot with Fox News, people drawn to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what is so interesting about that, about the political discourse in the country, is that's another place where we talk about the internet, like allowing people to be in these bubbles.
Yeah.
Like, especially like in the past year or so, discussions about race, people on the left, like myself, who are just, you know, who are maybe, like, for example, I come from Cincinnati, Ohio, which is extremely segregated, right? Mm. It has a history of racial tension. And in fact, one of the horrific police killings was there last year. People I know from my, you know, grade school, high school, will respond to some of the things that I post about Black Lives Matter in a way where I'm like, what universe are you living in? And the answer is, they're just living in the Fox News bubble. Right. Yeah, and Cincinnati, right. It's just, I'm living in another universe too. I'm living in a universe where I'm constantly hearing about Black Lives Matter.
Yes.
And, you know,
New York left liberal.
Yeah. So when people like respond in such a way that, like, they completely don't seem to get what's going on, it can be rather disheartening and shocking.
To their credit, though, at least they didn't block you. I have a lot of friends on Facebook that block everyone with an opposing opinion.
Yeah.
I don't.
It's also weird. I mean, anyone that knows you, Gary, anyone that knows you, Kevin, shouldn't be surprised that you're liberal. Mm-hmm. I mean, anyone that knows anything about you and your lifestyle and what you do for a living, Kevin, knows you're an open-minded person.
Right.
Like,
right.
How are they so outraged that you think that Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, I think that it's just that in that echo chamber, and we have our own echo chamber, but in that echo chamber of the right-wing propaganda machine.
Yeah.
People are just fed this emotional sort, emotional talking points where they're just, they can look at a video of a cop shooting a 12-year-old kid playing with a toy,
yeah,
and just be like, well, yeah, obviously he shot that kid. Who wouldn't? You know, and you're just like, wait, what?
It is amazing. Can you tell us what those three principles are of the book you're reading?
Yeah. What happened is we went to Toronto last year, and it was a great show, great audience. It's a great town.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't present. I was caught up doing something else, like talking to some fans after the show. And a fan came up to JC and said, can you deliver this to Kevin? And it was a book called The Inside Out Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
It's by this guy named Michael Neal. And it's really kind of interesting because there are two main people who teach these principles. There's a lot of people now, but there's two main people that seem to be
teaching the three principles.
Yeah.
Okay.
They are this guy, Michael Neal, and this other guy, George Pransky, who is he's a psychiatrist, but Michael Neal is just a self-help guy,
right.
Self-help guru. What happened was in around about 1974, this Scottish welder in the rural countryside of Scotland.
Hey, Jesus was a carpenter. Yeah. Who knows, right?
He was having a conversation with a friend, and the friend said, oh, Sid, you're not insecure. You just think you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that one sentence created some insight for this guy, Sid Banks, this Scottish welder. And he started having a series of insights and started jotting them down and called them the three principles.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing that's kind of unique about it is it's never been trademarked. There's no school. There's no practice. There's literally nothing to do. It's just a conversation this guy started, and they'll tell you, no, you're going to want us to say you have to do these things. There's nothing to do. We're just talking, and you walk away from this conversation and have whatever insights you might have.
So there's an opening for a cult leader here.
Yes, exactly. Like Michael Neal, I think, has done pretty well with his book and all. But even he constantly repeats this stuff. But yeah, that's true. Like any good cult leader would say, like, you know, like AA, this is not a religion. You know, every time I would go to an AA meeting and they would just repeat over and over, this is not a religion. It's like, they really doth protest a lot about that. But no, here's what the three principles are. That there are three phenomena in life that seem to add up to how we experience life. The principle of mind, the principle of consciousness, and the principle of thought. And here's the best way I can describe them. Mind, the idea there is that there is something greater. There is some creative intelligence that makes your cuts heal, makes a baby know how to work their hands after a while.
Something more intelligent than the conscious mind?
Than the individual's conscious mind.
Right.
Yeah, like there is some... there's something bigger, you know, whatever you want to call it. You could call it the unified field like David Lynch does. Right. Some people might call it God, whatever it is.
You can even call it the muse, you know, when a brilliant idea comes to you. And
Absolutely.
Where'd that come from?
The way that Michael Neal has described it is this. You might not be able to see the sun shining because there might be clouds in front of it right at that moment, mm-hmm. but it is always there. It's always bigger than you, and it's always giving to you some bit of energy. You are connected to it. So that's kind of what the principle of mind is, that there is a bigger creative intelligence that you're a part of and can tap into.
That's kind of how I think about the muse. That's like, I know she's floating around all the time, but I have to make myself available.
Right. You have to kind of, I guess, be present, you know, to like leave an opening.
Yeah.
My therapist says unclench.
Yes, exactly. Because once you try to be like, oh, there's the idea, then you're conscious of it and it goes away.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's similar to what you were saying before with trying to get back into meditation. Would you say a relaxed?
Yes. Well,
just observe, but don't quantify it.
When you were saying like when you're almost losing your connection to meditation to not consciously push yourself back into it.
Right.
I forgot what term you used, but just to sort of just like.
Don't get mad at yourself.
A less focused way of just letting yourself be open and let the muse come to you.
Well, what a lot of three principles people say is that you think there's something wrong with you. You might tend to think I could be doing better. I could accomplish more. There are things I'm not good enough at and yada, yada, yada. And the way Michael Neal puts it is there's nothing you need to do. There's nothing you need to be. You have complete and total well-being already deep inside you, and that's mind. That is that bigger thing that you're connected to. That ultimately, if you can quiet down your mind enough in meditation, you're tapping into this place of well-being and clarity and the original source, right. You know, that is always good enough, that always has plenty of energy and vitality and creativity and mm-hmm. all that. So that's that idea.
The irony is that if you get there, you will become more productive.
Yeah, right. Well, presumably. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that or if not more productive, at least more
clear.
Yeah, like, you might not be getting more done, but you might be getting more quality stuff done.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Right.
People that practice meditation usually say it makes them more productive.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you're less scattered about things and just more focused
and needing less distractions in your own life, whether it be
right.
substances or TV or whatever it is.
Oh,
if you're,
God.
If you're happier with yourself, you need less of the other distractions. You can get more done.
I love that idea. Okay, let me get on to the other principle.
Yes.
The second one is consciousness, the principle of consciousness. And this one is that there is a phenomena in our lives where we have this thing called consciousness, which allows us to experience, which allows us to entertain thoughts and have feelings. The way he puts it is, well, I'll get to the third one. The third one is the principle of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And that is this unending kind of parade of conscious thoughts, little things that where you literally think to yourself, holy shit, did I leave the iron on? And oh my gosh, you know, like that constant monkey mind
the
thought
little sparks
stuff.
Going on.
Right. And there's the kind of unconscious thoughts, like you can like be in a funk or something because of, I don't know, some generalized thought about something, mm-hmm. right? So the idea when you put thought and consciousness together is that consciousness is what enables a thought or generalized thought to start to occur to you as feeling and experience, right? So it's kind of like consciousness is a projector mm-hmm. and thought is the film. And the film being projected onto a screen is having the experience. So the point is that we are constantly kind of creating our experience because we think life is happening to us from the outside in, that we're seeing stuff and we're reacting to it. In fact, we're projecting onto life
what's on our insides.
Yes.
Yeah.
That our thoughts are creating our experience of what we're seeing. And all that needs, if we leave room for a new thought, we could be having a completely different experience in the flash of a second. So the three principles is not saying think positive. Mm-hmm. It is saying simply be aware that whatever you're thinking is not reality. It's mm-hmm. just a thought, mm-hmm. and you will be having a different thought a little bit later. It's just a passing thing. And the more you become aware of that, the more you develop an ability to step off of thoughts that aren't serving you, mm-hmm. right? So the more you realize, oh, there is always this bigger mind within me that I can calm down and kind of plug into and realize everything's okay and I have a place of clarity and peace and evenness and centeredness to go to, then whatever it is that's running through your head, it could be something incredibly traumatic, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, it's not saying that, oh, your mother was killed in a car crash yesterday. That's not reality. No, I mean, that happened.
Right.
It's just that how you're thinking about it at that moment is determining how you're feeling about it. You know what I mean? And you can always step off a certain kind of thought, leave room for a new insight, mm-hmm. or simply realize, okay, I'm having these kinds of thoughts. I'm probably going to continue having these kind of thoughts throughout the day because my mom was just killed in a car wreck. You know what I mean?
And it's okay to feel.
And it's okay. Yeah. This is not forever, and it's not necessarily reality that life is this way because my mom just died.
But is it saying that the way you're feeling is the way you're seeing the world? Like, oh, if you know, there's this self-help thing of like, think like a rich person, spend freely like a rich person, and you'll be rich, which is how you end up poor.
Yeah. No, oh my God. My brother and sister-in-law were gotten to the Landmark Forum.
Aha, uh-huh, yeah.
Which is big into living in luxury or living with the luxurious mindset or whatever.
Right.
And that did not go well for them.
Yeah. It's really dangerous. There is some truth to it. Like, you don't want to think like a poor person, but you want to be rational and reasonable with your finances.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Like my father used to say, you know, everything, you take everything with a grain of salt. You know, my sister-in-law, who has a shopping habit, is not the person to be hearing that message from the Landmark Forum.
She's, you know, like, I found my Bible. Yeah, it's really dangerous.
Yeah, so basically, at the end of last year, I read a lot of this three principles stuff by, and downloaded a lot of it is just lectures. Like George Pransky is really great because he talks very slow and has kind of a Boston accent and is kind of just like, it feels like you're listening to your dad, you know, very calm guy. He warns you at the beginning of every lecture, I talk really slow, but it helps things to sink in.
It puts you in that meditative state too, I would imagine.
It does, yeah. And what I've actually done is I created I don't know how much I believe in this or not, but I created a self-hypnosis tape for myself of it where there's a book called Instant Self-Hypnosis, which gives you scripts that you can read and you can record yourself saying these scripts. And then you can, so it's a hypnotic induction. And then I just wrote out a bunch of three principles ideas, like that idea that, you know, the sun is always shining, even though the clouds might be in front of it, or you're always
you always have complete and total well-being, or...
Did you record these with your voice and you just listen back to
it? Yeah, and then I just lay back, put on headphones, and, let myself fall into a hypnotic induction based on my own voice. And then there are these prompts from three principles in the middle of mm-hmm. it. And I'm hoping that it's having an effect on me.
Yeah, it's like reminders or affirmations.
Yeah. It's interesting. I guess you could say I'm a sucker for this kind of stuff.
Not if it's benefiting you.
Yeah, that's true. That's mm-hmm. true. I mean, I will say one thing. I was just talking about my sister-in-law having a shopping thing. I'm that kind of guy at the self-help section of the bookstore. You know what I mean?
Buying all the books. Yeah.
Like
I've done enough. I bought the book. That's it.
And Amazon really encourages that, because you see one title, and you're like, oh my gosh, well, here's another one that that's on a similar theme and got a lot of more, reactions.
Customers also bought this.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
It is it's the most growing section in the bookstore, is the self-help section.
Yeah, which is a little bit sad. I guess, it's one of those double-edged swords that we were talking about. It's a little bit sad because it makes it feel like we're becoming more and more desperate to get a sense of well-being, right? Yeah.
Or are we just more curious in working on ourselves?
It's true. There are a lot of people that express that this feeling, like that whole, the idea of the age of Aquarius. Do you know this? That one of my favorite authors, fiction mm-hmm. authors, is Robertson Davies, who died in the 70s, mm-hmm. but he once did a lecture to a commencement speech for at the University of Toronto. And he said, Robertson Davies was such a wonderful author because he was so interested in arcane stuff, in the history of theater and magic and Jungian psychology, and the tarot and all this. He just loved all that kind of stuff. But he said, what a lot of people don't know is that astrology, as ridiculous as it seems and as, just laughable as it is when you read like fortune-telling horoscopes and everything.
Yeah.
What a lot of people don't realize is that, it is actually a sort of a spiritual tradition that precedes, the great religions that we know today.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the mystics way back when, they laid out that every 2,000 years, you're in a new age, right? So when Christ was born, that was the beginning of the age of Pisces. And right. then in the year 2000, we crossed over into the age of Aquarius. But the age of Aquarius was, according to the mystics way, 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 way back when, going to be this incredibly precious era of transformation, these mm-hmm. 2,000 years.
Were they right?
And the theory that they had was that the age of Aquarius would begin with tremendous turmoil, because outdated ways of thinking would start to want to break out of those. Mm-hmm. They would not be like the old religions or philosophies would no longer be serving us so well, or ideologies. And we would want to kind of break out of those shackles. The tarot symbol for the beginning of the age of Aquarius is the tower falling. So in 2001, we see right at the beginning of the age of Aquarius, we are like filled with turmoil. We are very upset about old religions and old ideologies and what the hell is going on.
But can't you say that started in the late 60s, 70s?
Oh, absolutely. I think all of this stuff is like gathering storms.
Right.
And yeah.
And there was that Hair musical, the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
Right. They were trying to jumpstart it, I think. But the theory then, the mystics said, was that ultimately in the age of Aquarius, human consciousness would leap to a higher level. The mind, the collective consciousness would expand somehow, that it would be time for new ways of thinking, and that we would become much more connected. The brotherhood of man would become much more connected somehow. And that technology would play, that our own inventions would play some sort of role in all of this.
It's so interesting.
That's how Robertson Davies put it. And I think that a lot of people, when you do talk to, like, when you hear from people like the physicist David Bohm, mm-hmm. Or Eckhart Tolle or people like that, I think a lot of those people are hoping that there is some truth to that, that we are... that the self-help section of the bookstore is not just, oh, we're all kind of desperate and distracted, but that in actuality, we are hoping and trying to open up to and trying to invite new thinking.
What I'm seeing is, like, the technology has brought us together in an ideas way. Like, people are all harping on ideas, but I think it's made us more lonely. Because there's nothing like human connection and interaction in the physical form. You know, like being with people physically.
Yeah.
You know, chatting with people on Facebook is never going to replace that.
No. And you know, well, you know what's kind of interesting, though, is that Skype comes a little bit closer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, one of the things that I do on... I'm not a daily basis, but pretty regularly, is that I train people in storytelling one-on-one over Skype. Mm-hmm. And so that'll just usually be an hour session where someone from some part of the world is calling me and telling me some really revealing story about their life. And then we chat about it for, you know, an hour.
And you always do it video?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I always, you know, end the session when I hang up, I feel a little bit like, that was a really nice part of my day. I feel a little bit more connected because I shared with that person there. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Yeah, you're getting that. You're seeing their face. It's not quite a tactile experience.
Right. And, you know, there is something to be said for... something caught on video doesn't give you the full effect of what's really going on with someone's body language or in their eyes or that kind of, you know what I mean? It's still kind of like,
it's way better than a text.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Even better than a phone call.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does. When you're in person with someone, you can see, like, oh, that person's they're fidgety. They're moving their hands, and the other person can be sensitive to that.
That's absolutely true. I've done therapy before where I couldn't be in town at that time with my therapist and we were on the phone. I have never done it with Skype where we were looking at each other, but I was hyper aware during the phone call that we did together. Oh, is he cleaning his house right now? Yes. You know what I mean? That kind of thing where there's definitely a distancing thing.
I've done video Skype with therapists and there was something really beneficial about doing it in my bed. So it's like in my comfort of my bed and I'm having a therapy session. It's very unique. It's very different than going to her office. You know, you got to deal with the world and then you get out and you're like, oh my God, the world. Something kind of nice about that.
Yeah.
I think there's a whole opening for therapists to do that.
Yeah. As far as is the age of Aquarius just hopeful thinking, you know, I think we're all constantly wondering that sort of thing. Like, are things getting better or are things getting worse? You know,
right.
Like, for example, if Trump were to win the presidency next year, I think, you know, we would all be having a very hard time being like, well, this is just a thought, you know, let's see, right. Everything's okay.
Well, from our side, but from those people's side, it'd be like, shit, yeah, Kevin, things are getting a lot better. Look who we just elected.
That's a scary thought. God. So a lot of people, I mean, you had success at an early age, and then you kind of dipped down to do catering and odd jobs and stuff. And now you're experiencing a greater success with Risk. Did this meditation play into that at all, or spiritual awareness or awakening, for a heavier word?
Yeah, when I first started Risk, I was, you know, not drinking, but I was still smoking a lot of pot, and I wasn't really engaged in meditation or anything like that. I think that kind of what happened was I found my footing. You know, Risk, when I first put it together, I was kind of like penniless and started with zero, you know, started like using credit cards to get some of it done and all that kind of thing, the way that people often do. Mm-hmm. But once, you know, it was around for, I don't know, a year and a half or 2 years, and JC came on and we started to put together a well-oiled machine. I think that what happened was about maybe 3 years in, I started to feel like, okay, then I can start not resting on my laurels, but I don't know, party a little bit more. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. So I started smoking more pot, going to kink events, stuff like that. And then started drinking again.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. In 2014 and through the beginning of 2015, I was drinking again. I thought,
in a negative way, drinking?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I thought to myself, okay, I hadn't had a drink in 9 years by 2014. So, you know, I was very aware, hey, I started Risk not drinking, right? So, you know, not drinking might have really created some space for that to be able to happen. I was smoking pot, but not drinking. So in 2014, I thought, hey, let's see, now I'm in my 40s, and now I've got a business that's actually working. I've got steady income, yada, yada. Let's see if I can drink moderately now. And I think I said to myself consciously was, I give it a 30% chance. I'll probably have to like cut it off again.
You're a gambler.
Yeah. Right. And somewhere in there, I got my therapist, you know, so we went back and forth of, oh, like I thought of joining one of these moderation groups, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. There's something called, I think, moderation.org, and there's another thing called HAMS. Where people come up with their own programs. They're almost like AA groups, but they're there to help each other, like keep it
alcohol-ish anonymous.
Yes, exactly, exactly. But no, I mean, what I found is that what they say seems to be true, at least in my case, is that it does seem to metastasize. Mm-hmm. You go like when people get clean from heroin, for example, they'll go 90 days, their body kind of recalibers, mm-hmm. then they fall off the wagon and have heroin, and they want to have as much or a little bit more than they had the last time, and boom, their body is not ready for it, right? So when I started drinking again in 2014, it was not, I'll have a beer, it was, yeah, let's have 3 vodka martinis to get this thing started. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it was right to drinking, you know, at the heaviest state that it had ever been.
You started at 2 a.m. and not 9 p.m.
Did you feel like you were trying to, like, make up for lost time of not drinking?
I felt, you know, I do have to say that it was fun at first. You know, after 9 years, it was fun to be drinking mm-hmm. again. But what happened was, and I did it at a kink event, by the way. Like, it was, you know, I was definitely doing it at a kink event at a big hotel right down the street from the Capitol building in Washington.
Was it something you decided before you went there, or was it just
It was in the moment. Mm. See, which is not the way to do things, you know, it's in this. Most kink events happen out at camps where you're, you know, outdoors, nature, and, you know, you, if you want to go somewhere else, just go take a walk in the woods or whatever, you always have that option. This one was in a hotel where the bar was like the place where things were always. That was the hub for meeting anyone or talking to anyone. Yeah, yada, yada. And so the bar was just booming the whole weekend. And I was like, what the hell? Let's have a martini, you know? And at first it really was fun to be back. But what happened was it kind of stopped being so fun. You know, it kind of stopped being so fun, and problems I hadn't had before were happening, like blacking out. I remember, the second to last time I decided, no, this has to stop. I became conscious in a cab and knew I was on the way to an orgy, right? Uh-huh. And the conscious part of me was like, okay, you were just like blacked out. And then, you know, you spent a period of time not knowing where the fuck you were or who you were or whatever. Now you're conscious enough to realize, oh yeah, I'm in a cab. I'm on my way to an orgy, which is the wrong place to be going at this level of consciousness.
Right, right.
So I did have the wherewithal to say to the cabbie, turn back around and take me back home. So that was good. That was like, that was a very scary, like, you know, good thing I didn't get out and then start blacking out.
I've never heard of someone coming out of a blackout the same day. Usually it's like the next day you wake up, you're like, what the hell?
Well, then the second to last time was I had a guy over, we had brunch together. I decided, what the hell? Let's, you know, have some, lately, it's been the times that I've fallen off the wagon have been holidays, you know, have been like, well, it's Christmas or it's, you know, whatever it is. And this was one of, I don't remember what holiday it was, except maybe Labor Day or something like that. And I had a friend over and it was going to be, we were going to have sex and everything, but I woke, and this was in the afternoon that he came over, like, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I woke up at like 1 a.m., turned upside down in my bed, you know, not the way I normally sleep in my bed, and was like, whoa, what the fuck? I don't remember anything after coming home from brunch with that guy. I texted him and he was like, there's a bunch of towels thrown in the corner because you vomited.
Oh, no.
And he's like, you were a mess and I just had to go.
Mm-hmm. has someone ever videoed you in a blackout?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Watching yourself back while you're in a blackout is horrifying.
Oh my God.
Just like seeing yourself when you're like, I don't remember that at all. That's me, but I don't remember.
That's fascinating.
It's really weird. Yeah. Alcohol is one of the strangest. It's really the only drug I've ever known to black out on.
Yeah. You know, I think it's fascinating that it does not have the taboo that even marijuana has, which is rather tame by comparison.
Absolutely.
And the one of the things that people in AA say, which I think ultimately, like, this is the thing I've got to remember and remember and remember, is people who don't have a drinking problem don't have to think about it, right? Like, they can have a drink or they can take it or leave it, right? They don't have thoughts occurring to them all day long of, should I drink tonight? I'll have three tonight. Or wait, maybe a little earlier than, you know, like, that's me when I'm drinking.
They're not battling that demon.
I'm thinking about it, you know, several times throughout the day. And
that's how you know that's a problem. Yeah. It's Alcohol has never been a spiritually enlightening experience for anybody, I don't think.
at the time, you think it is. Like, oh my God.
Yeah.
This is everything.
It's great socially.
Until you wake up opposite with a pile of towels.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, I think that is one of the things that I regret about having to give up things, because you're right. It is fun socially. You know, it does help people to become more uninhibited. Mm-hmm. I do find, for me personally, and this is not the case for a lot of people, but pot works virtually the same way for me, is that it, like I was talking about hanging out with fans after Risk shows.
It takes you out of a shell?
It kind of stupids me up a little bit in a way that allows for a freer flow of conversation.
Yeah.
That might sound strange, but I do tend, and usually, not always, but usually, I do tend to have like a bit of social anxiety.
Sure, you have a dialogue going on.
Yeah. And, you know, like, oh, is this awkward right now? Or am I supposed to say something? And blah, 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 blah.
That sounds like stoned thought, actually. So it's happening opposite for you.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's the same way with vertigo.
Mm.
Vertigo, I sometimes suffer from vertigo, where I'll be wobbly on my feet, dizzy, nauseous, and all that. Marijuana is the thing that grounds me. Like Dramamine, that kind of stuff doesn't work. Uh-huh. It's marijuana that makes me feel like I'm centered. I can stand up and walk in a straight line across the room. It starts to make me feel normal again.
That is great. That's really great to have that.
Yeah. Yeah. So the last time I had vertigo, I was in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so funny because JC was with me, and I was like, no, we have to stop by a dispensary before I get on that airplane. And I was able to buy some, you know, like medical grade candies.
Uh-huh.
And the flight home was just fine and dandy.
Or did you bring on the vertigo so you can justify purchasing it?
Like, well, I told myself I'm not going to buy it anymore, but I have vertigo right now and I can get it right over there.
That is a JC idea. Believe me, she has said, are you going to start having these episodes? Like, literally, like, and I wouldn't put it past my unconscious to be able to do that, you know?
Yeah, rationalize anything.
Oh my God.
So if you're at a show and someone doesn't offer you pot afterwards, you're like, ah.
My fans suck.
God damn it, St. Louis.
I came all the way out here.
the spiritual thing, like, I've never done the ayahuasca thing, but I have a friend who like lives by it. And I have a problem equating a spiritual awakening with any sort of chemical.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've tried it twice, mm-hmm. and neither time has it worked. And here is my theory. I was on Cymbalta and Wellbutrin the first time I tried. And, you know, I took like 3 days off of them before doing it. But I don't think that was enough. And I was on just Wellbutrin the last time I tried. Now, Wellbutrin is supposed to not be as bad at getting in the way of...
But it's a beta blocker, right? Wellbutrin blocks those things that make you maybe anxious or paranoid.
I guess so. And that might be a big... Yeah. Well, the second time I did it, it was definitely a thicker, more sour, more like... felt like, oh, this is more like the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I had, you know, I was still on Wellbutrin, even though I'd been off it for 3 days. And I was like, nope, this is not doing it. So I wrote to the shaman,
mm-hmm.
and I said, is it the Wellbutrin? Should I try this after getting off of that? Because I'm kind of the opposite of what you were just saying. I totally get and respect, and maybe you're totally right, and maybe I should adopt that attitude. But I've heard stories from people who have done ayahuasca where it just sounded like that particular drug, and some people just on acid or mushrooms or peyote or whatever.
That absolutely has changed my life for sure.
Yeah. Acid?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mushrooms specifically.
Mushrooms. Yeah. Where, yeah. Well, yeah. My first hallucinogen that I ever did was mushrooms. And that was back in college before I had any antidepressants or anything like
that. That's the thing. I did it very young too. And I'm not sure if it's the drug or just, it was definitely the drug, but I was also very young and it opened my mind to like, it felt like the next day I was like, oh, everything is different now.
Yeah, it because for example, JC is someone who has never had a drink, never smoked pot, never had a cup of coffee. And
strictly heroin and crack.
Right. No, but I always feel like, oh man. I mean, I know that I'm not a good example because I keep having to give up things. But when it comes to those more profound drugs like mushrooms or ayahuasca or stuff like that, and my therapist totally agrees. My therapist is like, no, if you want to be doing that about 3 or 4 times a year, I highly recommend it, you know? Mm-hmm. I know some people also say that ayahuasca is temperamental about your psyche, you know? Some people theorize that ayahuasca is like, no, you're grasping too much, you're too needy, you've got too many hopes and expectations about what this is going to bring
you. So it won't work
for you. So I'm not dealing with you.
Whoa, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
You're not ready. Sorry, I'm not going to work for you.
Exactly. That's how they put it. That's how the Peruvians put it.
Okay.
But...
Well, that's nicer than being like, oh, you're not ready. I'm going to fuck your world up. I'm going to give you the worst trip ever.
Oh, well, the first time I did it, I'm waiting in line. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. And everyone looked like I said in the story I told about it. All the women look like Joni Mitchell or Joan Baez. So I'm talking to a girl who looks like Joan Baez. We're waiting in line for the bathroom. And I said, is it unusual that I've had 3 doses so far and I don't feel a thing? And she said, well, are you a raw vegan? I said, no. She said, oh, if you're not a raw vegan, there's too much of a Holocaust happening inside you right now for the medicine to want to have anything to do with you.
That's. I don't think mushrooms would. I can't imagine any drug being like, oh, you have meat or anything. You have a dairy product. Sorry, I'm not going to work.
I do want to go back to this shaman. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of, I mean, now this is not the only reason I want to get off Wellbutrin. I want to see, now that I'm becoming, you know, now that I've got meditation, now that I'm, you know, have put drinking behind me, now that I'm like, you know, I'm just getting more and more on stable footing. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to see if I can get the antidepressants completely out of my system. Mm-hmm. And I would love to. I mean, maybe, you know, like, I think I might know the friend you're talking about who regularly does ayahuasca.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it would be necessary to be doing it on, you know, every month, but I do think it could be a good thing to do, you know, every few months. I think what happens with those, my understanding is that what happens with those kinds of drugs, is that they open a hell of a lot more of the synapses in your brain.
Right.
So that there's a lot more, the neural pathways through which thoughts and feelings usually flow, suddenly there's just a lot more possibilities there. And when that stuff opens up like that, it just gives you the opportunity to, have some new thoughts or experience things on a slightly different plane. And I don't know. I love that idea.
Does it give you that connectedness you get, like from mushrooms or acid? You feel like, oh, everything's connected. You see the life in the chair.
I don't know because I haven't experienced ayahuasca. I haven't experienced it actually working.
Right.
But I'm kind of assuming it does. I'm kind of assuming because I've heard people talk about, you know, like looking at the moon and then suddenly feeling like they are the moon and then they're, you know, involved in a conversation with it or what. The one thing that I've heard consistently from people who do ayahuasca is that there is often a conversation, right, that you end up speaking to some sort of spirit or just – not maybe not literally speaking, but like in your mind, you're having a debate or a teaching session with some sort of spiritual guide. Mm-hmm. The one of the funniest stories about that that's been on Risk is the guy who, he's an older guy and he goes out to Colorado and he does peyote actually.
Uh-huh.
But it's a Native American shaman who's leading him through it. And he's like, this isn't working. And then he finally throws up and he's like, you know, because you're supposed to throw up at one point. And all of a sudden he just hears, you dirty rat.
Yeah, yeah.
Coming from the room, what he thought was the room next door.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh my God. The guy walks, he sees it. It's a gangster from the 1940s. Specifically the character Tommy Udo from Kiss Me Deadly.
Uh-huh.
It was the guy who, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, but he throws an old woman down the stairs in a wheelchair. So he's like, oh no, my spirit guide is Tommy Udo.
Was it his spirit guide or was it his demon?
Yeah, no, that's the thing. A lot of people will like, you know, it's the Blessed Virgin or something. And then other people like have to, the first story like this we ever shared on Risk, it was a woman who dealt with this voice that was just like, kill yourself, kill your, you know, like, so it was like, she got through the experience and considered it incredibly traumatic. And then during the circle the next day, she said to the shaman when everyone was like waking up the next morning, that was pretty terrifying for me. And she said he barely reacted. So she like drove away from the whole experience being like, God damn, fuck that. And then like a couple months later, she realized that nothing was ruffling her anymore. Like everything was just kind of like water off her back. And then she was like, oh, I faced the worst thing I had ever faced. Like, I faced some sort of demonic kind of voice telling me to kill myself and refused to give in to it. And everything ever since has been like hunky dory.
That sounds so similar to a friend of mine who his experiences, he saw little devils leave his body and they were facing him and he could see them as clear as day. And he described them to me, these devils, and the shaman saw the devils too, and the shaman was just like chasing the devils away with a drum, and he's banging the drum and he's yelling things, and my friend was like, get away, he's like fighting the devils, and they left. The devils just, they literally just ran away.
Holy shit.
And he said that it's changed his life. It's like he just purged something.
Did he have a conversation later with the shaman where the shaman said, yes, I saw those devils?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thing about, if you ever read the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, LSD is known to do that, where if people partake of the same batch of LSD, they will have the same hallucination. Shashi Musso shared that story where everyone in the room saw someone's head fall off and roll down the floor.
That makes sense to me. It's like mind meld.
Yeah.
You know, like that. And when improv groups get together and they do a mind meld, they all start saying the same words. And I can imagine it's even vastly improved when you're on hallucinogens.
Yeah. So I do, you know, as much as I would love to say, I mean, my relationship to substances is a love-hate relationship. You know, there are some, like alcohol, that and poppers that I'm like, no, I really need to put those totally behind me. There's a part of me that thinks, oh, it would be better to just be able to meditate my way toward better inner health and peace.
But who's got the time?
You're right. I mean, no, exactly. There's a part of me that's like, no. Every time I've done the ayahuasca, I felt like, oh, was I too much, like, too graspy and greedy for like, you know, let's have a eureka moment tonight.
It's like you're trying to lure a friend in or something.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, using these things is like tools. You know, you're using pot as a tool. You're using ayahuasca for a tool.
And it's really difficult to, or to just make sure that you're staying in that realm. You know what I mean? You walk a tightrope. You walk a fine line between using it in a greedy and sort of addictive and sort of compulsive, like give me way, and using it in a more sober, open, sort of way.
Yeah, I could tell the difference when people drink to escape or drink to just like relax and have a good time with
friends. For sure. Yeah.
With any drug, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, that escape thing is like, ooh, there, I know that.
I think it's when defines like, oh, he's a good drunk or a bad drunk.
Yeah.
You know, the so-called good drunks are the people that are just using to enhance what they already got, and the so-called bad drunks are the ones that all the bad stuff's coming out.
Yeah.
They're escaping.
Yeah, but
they're messy.
Some people could be jolly drunks. Great.
Oh,
people.
I'm a jolly drunk for sure. And this story that I'm working on for Risk right now is kind of shows some moments of that, you know, like, not so much that guy recently that I was talking about.
Well, I think that says a lot of good about you, that when you're totally inebriated, you're at least a good person.
Yeah. But you're right. But another thing about that is people who might be jolly drunks, a lot of them are, you know, rather nasty when sober, right? That's always fascinating, is to hear from people who are like, well, Dad was always okay as long as he was somewhat drunk. You know what I mean?
Well, are they nasty because they're not drunk and they're just having a bad reaction?
Yeah, right. No, probably the because I do think that alcohol, well, all of these substances, I think all of these substances change the weather of your emotions, you know?
Yes.
That's why I felt that in my late 20s, when I was smoking tons of pot, drinking tons of alcohol, and experimenting with all kinds of drugs, I felt like, oh, gosh, I mean, the weather in my heart and soul is just all the fuck over the place because of, you know, it's a stormy sea of various substances.
You're going up, then you're going down, then you're going,
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are just taking pharmaceuticals now, and I could sometimes tell if someone's like really up and down, I'm like, oh, they're probably have a prescription to Klonopin or something.
Yeah, I think we have to be really careful about that stuff.
Yeah, especially when your doctor prescribes it and you're like, okay, I'm making myself better because my doctor said so.
Yeah.
The pharmaceutical thing is a whole new issue.
Yeah.
We covered a lot.
We did. I don't know if we solved anything.
Oh, no. That's good. That's what we have more to talk about.
Great.
I don't think we missed anything.
I just wanted to address Kevin's, the way he objectifies Asian men. Just one more thing I wanted to cover here.
Nice. Well, the answer to that is on another podcast.
There you go.
Kevin, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.